Our next speaker is an old friend of the ginning industry, Bill Mayfield, who retired from USDA and now resides in Sillerton, Tennessee, who will present the topic, who really invented the cotton gin?
Thank you, Ron. Hello, all you old folks that I used to know. All of us have gotten old, it looks like, and good to see all of you. And I see my neighbor here, Andy Jordan, on the front row. And before I get into the topic, I want to say that I hope the next 15 minutes is fun. I plan to enjoy it, and I hope you do. I've spent a lot of time, as y'all know, going over this technical data and stuff like that, and enjoyed that at the time. And let me just say that thanks for the opportunity to come here and talk about this subject, and thanks, more importantly, for the opportunity to make a living, a good living, working with the cotton industry and good folks like you folks here. And as I said, 17 years ago when I retired from USDA, the best compliment you ever gave me, you gave me all your awards, and I appreciate them. The best compliment you ever gave me was treat me like one of you. And I'm speaking now primarily of you folks who actually own gins, run gins, manufacture gins, sell gins, and whatever. And so I appreciate that, and I couldn't have had a better career, and I appreciate it very much. The opportunity to work with your organization, so work very closely with Cotton Council and Cotton Incorporated and all those things. And also, to be more specific, to be involved in a time when the cotton industry was rolling and growing and really, really moving along, when the Beltwide Conference was 5,000-plus people, and sometime early, maybe 1990, whenever it was, that one of the Jenners called the Cotton Council and said, hey, there's nothing for Jenners to do at the Beltwide Conference. And I think Andy Jordan relayed the message, and Fred Johnson and I got busy and put together the first of these ginning conferences. When was it? 1990, 89, somewhere way back there a long time ago. And also the opportunity to work on the same leadership with establishing the gin schools. And I recall back there in 1 year down in Stoneville, we made the stupid mistake of trying to do a gin school from Monday morning to Wednesday noon, another one from Wednesday noon to Friday. Had 300 and something people there, you know. Big mistake. But it was a good mistake. We enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the rush of the industry cooperation there. Now, who would really invent the cotton gin? When I get through here today, you're still not going to know, okay? However, I think it's an interesting little book. I want to make one thing very, very clear. I am not here selling books. I do not get anything out of the sale of the books. They are available on Amazon. I think there's $19.95 or something. I haven't gone on. I haven't bought one. I told the co-author that when we started this that, you know, I didn't want any money out of it, and I don't. But he has invested in publication and professional editors and this kind of stuff. And so I think it is something that I think it'd make a wonderful gift for some people that you can't figure out what to get them for Christmas or whatever. And it's not that long, and I think most of you will enjoy it. How did the book evolve? Well, when I got out of college in March of 1966, I drove down to Leland, Mississippi, and Stoneville Ginning Lab, and worked there for about 5 years. And a guy named Charles Bennett, and Mr. Bennett was the first gin engineer, I guess, in the world. And they established that ginning lab in 1929, and he worked there until 1962, and he retired, and he died in 1964. So I never knew Mr. Bennett, but between 62 and 64, he did the basic research and was published by the Texas Cotton Gin Association, three spiral-bound booklets and about the evolution of the ginning industry. So he did the basic work there. And in the 90s sometime, I was on the ASAE, which is now ASABE, American Society of Agricultural and Biological Engineers, a change that Dr. Parnell and I fought hard 15, 20 years ago, and we lost, and it was good that we did lose. It would have been better as it turned out. But anyway, I was on the National Historic Commemoration Committee, and the committee I guess I was the only one involved with the cotton bin. It's recognized again as one of the major developments in the history of the world. But no one had any background in it, so I was the one that did a little research. And so what I did, I went back to Mr. Bennett's references and pulled them up and tried to dig a little deeper. And throughout the time, a lot of y'all have heard me talk about this, the gin schools and other stuff, of what I had pulled together, a little bit more than Mr. Bennett did, but not a lot more. But about, I think it's 05 or 06, Dr. Wes Buechele. Now, Wes Buechele is a retired professor at Iowa State University. I knew him. He was on this historic commemoration committee in the 90s. Well, he got interested in the ginning. And Wes is 95 or 96 years old now. And he's published a number of books. He has 15 or 20 or 30 patents, including patents dealing with the rotary grain combine early on and the round hay baler that we now use. Quite an interesting individual. So he went down and went through Georgia and South Carolina, went to courthouses, dug up lawsuits, and he really dug significantly deeper into this, a lot deeper than I did, and probably a whole lot deeper than Mr. Bennett did. And so he came up with all this information, and he's the one that, and when he got, I think he got almost ready to publish it, and he really wasn't happy with it. And then he asked me to join him and whatever, and I would have written the book a lot differently than Mr. Wes Buechele did. It jumps around a little bit from Ed. You've read it, you know, and it repeats stuff. And even though it's been two or three professional editors, I think it could have been done better. But there's some really good information in there. A few key points. How much time we got? 5 minutes. A few. Not that I ever bothered me before, Ron. But, and now that I've gotten older, those kind of things, I never did bother me much, but they don't bother me near as much now as they used to. Well, I don't have a boss anymore, except for my wife, and she's pretty nice to me. A few points to remember, and in the book there's a lot more to do with that. And we're talking about Holmes and Whitney. And as a result of our work with ASAE at the time, we agreed, and the information we found that both Whitney and Holmes made significant contributions to the development of today's cotton gin. So we put a marker up in Savannah, Georgia, which is close to the area where this is, out on there, in what used to be the cotton exchange at Savannah there, basically giving somewhat equal credit to both of them, to each of the guys. But some of the facts, some dates. 1787, Henry Ogden Holmes, who is referred to in the literature in the book as Hogden Holmes, and I really think he signed his name as H. Ogden Holmes, and somebody pushed them together, and he became, maybe he didn't even go by Hogden. Maybe that's after he was dead. But anyway, he was a blacksmith in Kincaid Plantation in South Carolina. But in 1787, he applied for a caveat on a machine to gin cotton. Now, this was before the patent office was established. It was issued by the War Department, and he applied for one in 1787. 1789, March 24th. Remember March 24th. His caveat was granted by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, two of the people who signed his caveat. Okay? March 24th, 1794. March 24th, 1789. Caveats lasted 5 years. Okay? 5 years to the day when his caveat was issued, the day it expired, Eli Whitney received a patent for machine to gin cotton. This happened to be 5 years to the day later. A little background. Holmes was a blacksmith, worked on the plantation, kept the gee whizzes and the harrows. Robbie, you can deal with that probably from your older day, younger days, going. And then Whitney was a Yale graduate who was down in Georgia teaching the General Greene's homeschooling, General Nathaniel Greene's children. General Greene had died. He was a good friend of George Washington. He had gone into George Washington's office as a private citizen and walked out a general. No military training, whatever. Because in those days, your rank was equal to whatever number of men you could furnish. They had to raise their money to furnish their troops. So they were on first-name basis, so close that after the General Greene, when the war was over, General Greene got spoils of war, plantation down in South Georgia, and that's where he died, and that's where Whitney went down to tutor the children. Now, there's a whole story there about Mrs. Whitney and Mr. Miller and that kind of stuff. And my good buddy Ed Hughes gave me a copy of this book called Katie in 1995. Ed, because you wrote the date in there. I wouldn't have thought it had been that long. And I also recommend you look at it, because you will see that the Greens and the Washingtons were so close that the Greens would send a child to Washington each year so they could go to school. You know, it's just like today. The schools down there in South Georgia are not worth anything anyway, so they had to send them somewhere to go to school. Where's your Georgia folks? Somebody boo at me back there. Now, that's meant for... I expected a boo or a yell on that one, because it's strictly in fun. Okay, back to our dates, and I see we got less than a minute to go. 1787, 5 years later, Whitney's patent was issued. In 1796, Holmes came back and got a patent on a continuous flow cotton gin. The difference in Whitney and Holmes' design is that Whitney's was a batch operation. Hand turn, rake the cotton in, turn it by hand, dig the seeds out with what wasn't ginned. Holmes' patent, move the ribs out, and the geometry of the roll box, just like similar to what we have today, not just like, there's 1,000 patents since they interchange them, but where the seed would fall out the bottom. Continuous flow operation, and very simple engineering. Continuous flow is much easier to automate than anything that's a batch operation. Okay, 1802, a stupid judge nullified Holmes' patent, saying that his was, quote, merely an adaptation of Whitney's patent. He did not recognize that continuous flow was so much more important than a batch-type operation. In 1806, another judge decreed a permanent injunction against Holmes' estate for that. 1788 to 1796, the Kincaid Plantation, where Holmes worked, grew, sold, they ginned 240 pounds of lint per day, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 24 hours a day. Remember, a person can only hand gin about a pound a day. So, obviously, they had something going there to gin that cotton. It would have taken 240 people to gin by hand, working every day that much. So it's pretty obvious there what may have happened there. All circumstantial evidence. There's nothing that we've presented here that would hold up in court, but it's pretty clear what the conclusion is. Three gins I'd like to encourage you to go look at if you're vacationing or whatever. In Lumpkin, Georgia, there's an operational gin, circa about 1850. My wife just told me what the name of that place was, but what was it, dear?
Westfield.
Yeah, and it's operational in the fall. It was the last time I was there, just a few days during the festival. The Agorama in Tifton, Georgia, about a 1900s Lummis plant there, circa 1900. And, of course, the Burton gin here in Texas is, I think, 30s or 35 in that general time. My conclusions are lots of circumstantial evidence that Whitney and his investors may have not been come up with the original idea. But the fact is that Holmes' patent is state-of-the-art technology from 1794 to 1796, and it is to basically Holmes' patent is basically the the gins like we see today, with lots bigger and lots of adaptations and lots of improvements. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming here. I'm looking forward to visiting with a lot of you folks. Gail and I just got in here today, and I want to tell you one thing about, where's Dr. Falco? He's over here. You know, Tommy is he's a really a nice guy, but don't ever get on a boat with him, but he has no mercy. He'll catch every fish in the water.